From the Voice of America in Washington, this is VOA Global. Hi, I'm Jim Stevenson. Coming up on today's program, China reacts to the impact of regulations on high-tech firms from outside the mainland. That's coming up in just a moment on Daybreak Asia. Women's rights in South Korea have improved dramatically over the past 40 years. We hear from an author who is looking ahead for more change. Internet controls in China are increasingly squeezing and filtering the flow of information to users. Sarah Williams logs on with details on China Focus. We explore today's climate and try to learn about its changes from a gooey tar pit in California. Ira Melman wades into the science inside the American Cafe. The Apple Watch isn't yet available, but already its competitors are vying for your time. That's what's happening now with David Byrd. We'll have business and sports as well, all coming up on today's VOA Global. We're glad you could join us for Daybreak Asia, our summary of Asian news and events for Thursday, March 5th. I'm Jim Stevenson. Among today's headlines, China has responded to criticisms raised by President Barack Obama about regulations that could impact high-tech firms. The spokeswoman for China's top legislative body says that companies doing business on the mainland have nothing to fear from a new anti-terror law that is under review. VOA's Bill Ide has more from Beijing.
According to the draft anti-terrorism law, high-tech firms operating in China would be required to hand over encryption keys and install backdoors to aid counter-terrorism investigators in their work. U.S. President Barack Obama warned in an interview with Reuters that Beijing would have to change those provisions requiring government access if Chinese companies wanted to do business in the United States. Speaking at a news conference Wednesday, one day before China begins meetings of its National People's Congress, parliamentary spokeswoman Fu Ying tried to reduce tensions over the increasingly heated debate. She says Chinese companies doing business in the United States are also subject to intense security checks. She says Mr. Obama's concern about the legislation is a sign of progress, showing the two sides are engaged on the issue. She says the regulations in the law are set up in accordance with the principles of China's administrative law and in line with international practices. She says they will not affect the interests of Internet firms. China's draft anti-terrorism law just passed its second reading, and the legislation could be approved in the coming weeks or months. But the provision requiring companies to provide backdoor access to government officials has raised alarms in the United States. Mr. Obama says this is an issue he and others in his administration have raised directly with China's President Xi Jinping and Chinese authorities.
Those kinds of restrictive practices, I think, would ironically hurt the Chinese economy over the long term, because I don't think there's any U.S. or European firm, any international firm that can credibly get away with that wholesale turning over of data, personal data, over to a government.
The draft anti-terrorism law is not the only regulation that Chinese authorities are currently considering that would require foreign companies hand over such information, opening them up to surveillance and forcing them to hand over sensitive intellectual property. In the wake of former NSA contractor Edward Snowden's revelations about U.S. government spying capabilities, China has increasingly tightened its cybersecurity policies. Bill Ide, VOA News, Beijing.
Indian authorities have blocked the screening of a BBC documentary amid a massive outrage over a controversial interview with one of the rapists in the brutal gang rape that shook the country 2 years ago. But as Anjana Pasricha reports from New Delhi, some say the solution does not lie in banning the film, but in changing a social mindset that devalues women.
Saying that women who go out at night have only themselves to blame, Mukesh Singh, one of the six men who raped a 23-year-old physiotherapy student in December 2012, told a BBC filmmaker that a girl is far more responsible for rape than a man. Singh is in New Delhi's Tihar jail as he appeals his death sentence for the rape of Jyoti Singh on a bus she boarded after watching a film at night. Showing no remorse, He told filmmaker Leslie Udvin that had Jyoti Singh not resisted the rape, they would not have inflicted the savage beating that led to her death. She should have been silent and allowed the rape, he said. The hour-long documentary, India's Daughter, in which the interview is being featured, is scheduled for broadcast by BBC 4 on March 8th. An Indian TV channel was also to telecast the film. But as massive outrage erupted over Singh's comments, police moved swiftly to block his interview, saying it could create an atmosphere of fear and tension with the possibility of public outcry. Television channels have been advised not to broadcast the film. Home Minister Rajnath Singh accused the filmmakers of violating the conditions under which permission was given for the interview.
It was noticed that the documentary film depicts the comments of the convict, which are highly derogatory and are an affront to the dignity of women.
Ranjana Kumari, who heads the Center for Social Research in New Delhi, said Mukesh Singh's response was typical of widespread attitudes among men.
I don't think that any discovery has been made by what he has revealed. This is what the rapist mindset is all about. I mean, if at all any interview was to be done, it should have been for a psychiatrist's purposes or for a sociologist to analyze, to really, bring this kind of interview out and then to play it. And sell it. I think this is totally unacceptable. It is really a violation of dignity of women.
The outrage is not just over the rapist's comments. Angry questions are also being raised over why a foreign filmmaker was granted permission to interview Singh and other rapists in jail. Filmmaker Udvin defended the film at a special screening of the movie held in New Delhi on Tuesday before it was banned. Udvin, herself a sexual assault victim, says she had the necessary approvals and is saddened by the move to ban it. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
Tensions are rising again on the Korean Peninsula as the United States and South Korea conduct joint military drills this week. Nearby in Seoul, a former chief U.S. negotiator for North Korea nuclear talks addressed a conference on the unlikely prospects for peace in the Korean Peninsula. We hear more now from VOA's Brian Patton in Seoul.
Every year, the United States and South Korea conduct a large-scale, weeks-long military exercise involving thousands of troops to prepare for a possible attack from North Korea. And every year, Pyongyang responds with harsh rhetoric and a display of military force. This year is no different. Pyongyang fired two missiles into the sea on Monday. On Wednesday, North Korea's foreign minister warned his country has the nuclear capability to conduct a preemptive strike. Former U.S. Ambassador to South Korea Christopher Hill spoke at a conference in Seoul about the prospects for peace moving forward. He says North Korean leader Kim Jong-un seems to be just as intent as his father Kim Jong-il in making North Korea a prominent nuclear power.
If Kim Jong-un is interested in doing away with their nuclear weapons, let's put it this way, he hasn't shown that yet.
Military readiness remains a priority on both sides of the Korean border as tensions rise and no imminent, meaningful prospects for peace seem to be forthcoming. Brian Patton, VOA News, Seoul.
I'm Jim Stevenson. Daybreak Asia is a weekday feature of VOA. At voanews.com, we have longer versions of these stories, many with great photos and video. And be sure not to miss one episode of Daybreak Asia. Subscribe to our free podcast. We enjoy presenting all kinds of stories to you here at VOA, and we love hearing the feedback that you give to us. So we're going to give it right back to you and tell you some of the comments that you've been telling us. You just heard Brian Patton and that story about tensions rising on the Korean Peninsula as the United States and South Korea are conducting joint military drills this week. Bill Webb writes to us on our website, voanews.com. North and South Korea have maintained a sometimes uneasy truce for over 50 years. The only significant development since the truce began is that the North has developed nuclear weapons and the South has developed a robust economy. It never was necessary for the North to develop these weapons to prevent an attack by the South or the U.S., and he continues to write, despite international efforts to curtail the North's nuclear ambitions, they have continued on this path. Indian authorities have blocked the screening of a BBC documentary amid a massive outrage over a controversial interview with one of the rapists in that brutal gang rape that shook the country 2 years ago. Molly wrote to us, "By pretending such rapist attitudes doesn't exist, that will make them go away? Of course not. As with any infection, the poison must be drained out in order to clean out the wound and heal. Such documentaries can help air out such underlying attitudes." Another story on our website, two Australian drug smugglers in Indonesia were taken from their Bali prison Wednesday to an island where they are to be executed. Hugh Jorgen from Western Australia comments, "So Prime Minister Tony Abbott sets himself up as the national spokesman for our country and says millions of Australians are sickened by the upcoming executions. Their punishment is one of the hazards for their chosen professions." We invite all of your comments to our stories. You can write to us at voaasia@voanews.com or just click on our website and comment there. This is VOA Global from the Voice of America. I'm Jim Stevenson with you today. We've been asking you for the last few days to send in your photos from the recent Lunar New Year celebration. Now, we've got the Lantern Festival going on and lots of great opportunities to take some pictures of the festival, festivities all around you. And what we're going to do is collect all these photos. We're going to choose one, and then we're going to put it right at the top of our Facebook page. Stay tuned. South Korea has changed dramatically since the rule of controversial military dictator Park Chung-hee, who decades ago perpetuated a suppression of civil rights in the country and was especially harsh with regard to the role of women in society. I'm Jim Stevenson with Authors on Asia. We open the book today with Sung Kyung Kim, professor and chair of the Women's Studies Department and director of the Center for East Asian Studies at the University of Maryland. Her book, The Korean Women's Movement and the State, examines resistance in Korean social movements.
I wanted to do something that is fair rendition of what has been going on at the time in early 2000s. The most important part that I thought was how academy and the government and the civil society, how this three-way dynamics would be playing out to affect women's lives.
You were recounting, at least in the preface, being a college student and writing for the school newspaper, which must have been a very interesting time and gave you a lot of fundamental ideas for this.
In many ways, we were shut out of our college years by demonstrations, shutting down of the college, and thinking about what does, you know, the social movement mean to the society that was evolving like South Korea at the time and, you know, afterwards, 80s, 90s, and now, you know, we are talking about 2014, and the role of women in all of these years, in not only in the student movement, the labor movement, but in this book, of course, in women's movement.
Well, in just six chapters, you cover some of the seminal events of the women's movement in South Korea over the past decade. The enactment of the law against prostitution in 2004 was a turning point in this movement.
Yes, that law in 2004, which many, and I will say many and maybe most, of Korean feminist scholars I'm talking about and women's movement organization activists all thought prostitutes will embrace this law wholeheartedly. And they were surprised when prostitutes staged demonstration after demonstration saying that this law does not and is not going to help them.
We like to say here in the United States that all politics is local, and you write about the personal and family aspects of politics from the mid-2000s on, particularly the abolition of the family head system and then rolling into the family law and child care policy.
Yes. Ever since the family law was established in 1948 and onward, women's organizations wanted to revise the family law. abolishing the family head system was in a fundamental change in Korean society, and it signaled in a way that there is no going back.
No matter what the social change and the degrees of it, there's always something to look forward to or something to press ahead with. And that's pretty much your conclusion, that the Korean women's movement is currently at a crossroads with such issues still needing some work and attention.
That's absolutely right. The movement activism will again gather its forces and will deal with the issues that they are facing with. I hope this book will be read by ordinary Korean women who want to find out about, so what happened to those legal changes and who made it happen and who were affected.
Sungkyun Kim, professor and chair of the Women's Studies Department and director of the Center for East Asian Studies at the University of Maryland, also author of The Korean Women's Movement and the State, Bargaining for Change. It's published by Routledge. I'm Jim Stevenson. We'll pull another volume from our bookshelves next week when you may hear more Authors on Asia on VOA Global or anytime by visiting the voanews.com website, VOA Asia Facebook page, and SoundCloud.
I'm Sarah Williams with China Focus. This month, China tightened its internet controls even further. The move comes at a time when the reach of social media continues to expand. VOA's Bill Ide has more from Beijing.
According to the Cyberspace Administration of China, the new regulations require users who post comments online or in chat rooms and blogs to register using their real name and agree to abide by a code of conduct. That code includes pledges that users will not criticize the Communist Party, make racist remarks, nor post pornography. For several years now, China has been requiring internet companies to collect the real names of users, but compliance has been mixed at best. Eric Harwit is a professor of Asia Studies at the Hawaii-based East-West Center, who monitors cyber activity in China. He says that although the regulations are not new, authorities do seem to be sending a signal that users will be punished if they push too far.
Up till now, the internet service providers, the websites that host chat rooms and microblogs or Weibo in Chinese, have been rather lenient about enforcing these kind of rules. Now the Chinese government is really trying to impress on those mainly private companies that they really do have to watch what kind of content people are posting on their sites.
Last April, China launched a campaign to clean up online content. Authorities fined Sina Corp nearly $1 million for unhealthy and indecent content. In December, the Ministry of Culture announced that 11 companies, including Tencent and Baidu, would be fined as well for similar violations. Harwit says that the new rules may make people a little more conservative for a while, but the regulations are unlikely to change much in the long run.
The government really, I think, doesn't want to really shut down a lot of the communication, I mean, the vast majority of which is positive for Chinese social and economic development.
Xu Feng, head of the Cyberspace Administration of China's Mobile Internet Bureau, told the Global Times that while the regulations require a real name, users would still be able to personalize their usernames. According to official statistics, China has more than 600 million internet users, and estimates of social media users are in the hundreds of millions as well. And the numbers continue to grow. A survey released by Kantar, the Data Management Investment Division of the Global Consultancy Group, WPP, found that while enthusiasm for social media was shifting in China, its reach continues to expand. According to the survey, the number of heavy users of social media among urban residents grew last year to 34%, from about 28% from the previous year. The number of older Chinese who use social media every day also grew. The survey of around 53,000 respondents living in 60 cities in China found that not only did growth expand among younger users, but also those who are less educated and living in smaller cities. CTR Market Research's Media and Consumption Behavior Group carried out the online polling survey for Kantar. The group's general manager, Sophie Shun, says that although those born in the 1990s became the largest grouping of social media users in this year's survey, those born in the 50s, 60s, and 70s also saw an increase in usage. Shun says that in the past, it was the younger generation, those born in the 1980s and 1990s, that made up the majority of social media users. But now usage is spreading from families to friends to reach the broader general public. The survey found, however, that as the landscape of social media expands, enthusiasm for it as a medium has slipped. According to the results of Kantar's second annual China Social Media Impact Report, nearly 65% of those surveyed said they felt positively about social media, down 12% from the previous poll. Shun says that some noted that their opinion towards social media was shifting because of the impact it was having on their sleep and natural social interactions with others. She says others expressed concern about how it was affecting their ability to concentrate and disrupting daily routines. Bill Ide, VOA News, Beijing.
Follow us on Weibo. That's China Focus. I'm Sarah Williams.
I'm Jim Stevenson with Asia Business News on the Voice of America. Hong Kong shares finished lower Wednesday following weaker U.S. and European markets and as a sharp drop in domestic retail sales hurt investor sentiment. Banking stocks also declined as investors worried about China's slowing economic growth and on concerns that further interest rate liberalization by Beijing would threaten the profitability of Chinese lenders listed in Hong Kong. The Hang Seng Index fell 1% to close at 24,465. The China Enterprises Index lost 1.7%. It is now at 11,738. Japan's Nikkei share average dropped to a one-week low as an overnight fall in U.S. shares triggered profit-taking after the index scaled a 15-year peak earlier in the week. The Nikkei ended 0.6% lower at 18,703. Noticeable decliners included Sharp Corporation, which dropped 5.3% after a cut to its credit rating by Standard & Poor's. Sharp fell by as much as 10% at one point on Tuesday. North Korea is trying to invigorate its economy by offering more control and possibly more personal rewards to key sectors of its workforce in the country's biggest domestic policy experiment since leader Kim Jong-un assumed power. The measures give managers the power to set salaries and hire and fire employees, give farmers more of a stake in outproducing quotas. Some outside observers say they're a far cry from the kind of change the North really needs, but they agree with North Korean economists who say it is starting to pay off in higher wages and increased yields. The changes were introduced soon after Kim took over in late 2011, codified last May, and according to North Korean economists, they are now being expanded to cover the entire country. That's a look at Asia Business News on VOA Global.
This is Today in History. On March 5th, 1496, King Henry VII of England issued letters to Italian John Cabot and his sons, authorizing them to explore unknown lands. Cabot is believed to have been the first European to set foot on the North American continent since the 11th century. Cabot's ships disappeared during a third exploration voyage, and most historians presume that he was lost at sea. In 1770, five civilians were killed in Boston, Massachusetts, when harassed British soldiers opened fire after being hit by thrown objects. The incident is seen as an indication of increasing hostility between American colonists and the mother country. Within a decade, the colonists would declare independence from Britain and fight a war to gain nationhood. On this day in 1933, newly inaugurated U.S. President Franklin D. Roosevelt responded to a growing banking crisis by declaring a national bank holiday. He suspended all financial transactions for 5 days while the administration and Congress wrote legislation designed to ease public distrust of the banks. Also on this day in 1933, Adolf Hitler's Nazi Party received 43.9% in parliamentary elections. Although not getting a majority, the Nazis used their high vote count to later pass the Enabling Act, which set up a dictatorship with Hitler in charge. In 1940, a recommendation for the secret execution of more than 25,000 leading Polish citizens and military officers was sent to Soviet dictator Joseph Stalin. The order was dated March 5th. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. Coming up, Russian President Putin speaks out against the recent murder of one of his greatest domestic critics. We'll have a report on how young Muslims are being radicalized on the web. And we'll look at the start of a trial in Boston for a suspect in one of America's worst recent terror attacks. I'm Michael Lippin. Russian President Vladimir Putin has denounced last week's murder of Russian opposition leader Boris Nemtsov as a disgrace to the country. In remarks to Russian law enforcement agencies on Wednesday, Mr. Putin called on them to focus on solving the Nemtsov case as well as similar crimes from recent years. Mr. Putin said the most serious attention should be paid to high-profile crimes, including those with a political motive. He said Russia should finally be spared the kind of shame and tragedy we have recently endured and seen. By that, I mean the audacious murder of Boris Nemtsov right in the center of the capital. Russian news agency Interfax quoted the head of Russia's main security agency on Wednesday as saying authorities have identified suspects in the Nemtsov murder. Nemtsov, an outspoken critic of the Russian president, was shot in the back four times last Friday, just steps from the Kremlin. A top U.S. official says Washington is considering imposing new sanctions against Russia if Moscow and its rebel allies in Ukraine continue alleged violations of a ceasefire deal reached last month in Minsk. Speaking to U.S. lawmakers on Wednesday, Assistant Secretary of State for European and Eurasian Affairs Victoria Nuland said Washington has sent a team to Europe to coordinate Russia sanctions with allied governments. Nuland said those new measures would be imposed should Russia continue fueling the fire in eastern Ukraine, as she put it, or if Russia and its rebel allies fail to implement the Minsk truce and seize more land. Russia has long denied providing direct assistance to the Ukrainian separatists. Ukrainian rebel authorities in the country's east say a coal mine explosion has left dozens of miners missing and feared dead. Authorities in the Ukrainian separatist stronghold of Donetsk said Wednesday's explosion was not caused by shelling that has frequently hit the area. A rescue operation was underway at the Zasyadko coal mine in Donetsk. Some injured miners reported seeing five bodies retrieved from the mine. Initially, some officials in the Ukrainian government-controlled capital of Kiev reported that at least 33 people had died in the mine blast, but they later said those figures could not be confirmed. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says U.S. and Iranian negotiators have made some progress in nuclear talks, But Kerry said there are still significant gaps and important choices that need to be made, as he put it. Kerry was speaking on Wednesday after wrapping up 3 days of talks with Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif in Montreux, Switzerland. Kerry said negotiators continue to focus on reaching what he called the right kind of deal, which he said would be one that closes off any paths that Iran could have toward fissile material for a nuclear weapon. Iran says its nuclear activities are peaceful. International terror experts say young Muslims are being radicalized in their bedrooms through direct contact with Islamic State fighters via the internet. They suspect that is what happened to three British schoolgirls whom authorities believe recently traveled to Syria to join the Islamic State group. Henry Ridgewell has more from London.
What drove these high-achieving students to leave their families for a war zone to likely become the partners of Islamic State fighters? Britain's lead counter-terrorism police officer, Peter Fahey, blames social media.
The change we've seen over the last few years is that these extremist messages are now pumping through the internet right into your child's bedroom.
It is a phenomenon that is happening with increasing frequency across the world as part of the IS foreign recruitment drive for both male fighters and potential female partners, according to terror expert Shiraz Meher of King's College London, speaking at the Policy Institute Chatham House.
Today, you can have a direct dialogue with a fighter. You can ask them what life is like on the ground. You can ask them how they got there. And that, in many respects, helps you overcome your own fears or whatever it is that's stopping you from going.
Security analysts say extremist propaganda on the web must be countered using the same internet tools to prevent more young people from turning online curiosity into radicalised reality. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Almost 2 years after one of the most notorious acts of terrorism on U.S. soil, the trial of a man suspected of participating in the 2013 bombing of the Boston Marathon has begun. Tsarnaev, now 21, has pleaded not guilty to 30 counts against him stemming from the explosion of two bombs at the marathon finish line in April 2013. The explosions sent shrapnel into hundreds of people, killing three and wounding more than 260. Carolyn Persuti has more from Boston.
Today, inside this courtroom, the trial begins for 21-year-old Dzhokhar Tsarnaev, who is accused of planting those bombs, along with his brother, 26-year-old Tamerlan. Tamerlan was killed in a gun battle with police 2 years ago. Dzhokhar Tsarnaev sat in court today and fidgeted a bit. He wore a white shirt and a suit and at times acted uninterested. When the prosecution spoke, they said that Dzhokhar Tsarnaev used a bomb that, quote, was favored by terrorists because it was designed to tear people apart. Those bombs were pressure cooker bombs inside backpacks left at the finish line. The defense attorney agreed that it was her client who left the backpacks at the finish line, but then she disagreed with the prosecution. Attorney Judy Clark said it was Tamerlan Tsarnaev, the 26-year-old brother of Dzhokhar, who was into violent Islamic extremism and who, quote, explored jihad on a visit to Russia. He enlisted his brother into these horrific acts, she said. Courtroom observers think that Attorney Clark is setting up for the next phase of the trial, which is the sentencing phase, in which her client could receive the death penalty. This case is expected to last several months. In Boston, Carolyn Persuti, VOA News.
The U.S. Justice Department has concluded that the police department in the Midwestern U.S. city of Ferguson, Missouri, routinely violated the constitutional rights of its black citizens. In a report released Wednesday, the Justice Department found that although African Americans are only 67% of the Ferguson population, they make up 93% of arrests in the city. U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder said the report found that policing in Ferguson was disproportionately harmful to black residents and stemmed in part from racial biases, both implicit and explicit. That's it for International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Michael Lippin. Thanks for listening.
From the Voice of America, this is Business News. I'm Jim Stevenson. U.S. stocks closed lower Wednesday for the second day in a row as investors stepped back after a recent rally. Healthcare stocks were the only bright spot after a U.S. Supreme Court hearing and a cancer drug approval. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell over 130 points to close at 1872, the S&P 500 shedding 12 points. It is now at 2095, and the NASDAQ Composite dropped 16 points, about 0.33%, to close at 4963. Well, Americans may just be getting used to mobile pay, but consumers in many African countries have been paying with their phones for years. Now, payment processors Visa and MasterCard want to get a slice of that market and are launching card services aimed at Africa's growing mobile payment industry. Visa is partnering with African telecommunications and a link to Visa cards and customers on mobile phones. While many Africans do not have bank accounts, most do have cell phones, sometimes more than one. Gallup estimates that 80% of sub-Saharan African households have a cell phone, while only 2% currently have a landline. ExxonMobil CEO Rex Tillerson expects the price of oil to remain low over the next 2 years because of ample global supplies and a relatively weak economic growth. Speaking at the company's annual investor meeting in New York, Tillerson continued that geopolitical turmoil could unexpectedly send prices higher. He said, though, if tensions calm, much more oil is ready to hit the market, a market that is already flush with crude oil. Exxon's presentation to investors outlining its business plans through 2017 assumes a price of $55 a barrel for global crude. That's a look at business on VOA. Well, it took them about 40 years. And as a weekend staple here on U.S. television screens, Saturday Night Live will now begin a Chinese version in a partnership with Sohu.com, operator of an online search engine and video streaming sites. Comedians from across China will be hired for the show, featuring live music and a sketch comedy. A Beijing-based professor, though, said what Sohu needs to be careful of is finding the right balance when doing satire about social and political issues.
I'm Ira Melman in the American Cafe. Dogs have been called man's best friend, but communication between the species is limited because dogs can't talk. However, researchers have developed a sensitive computer interface that improves two-way communication between a dog and his handler. VOA's Jessica Berman is in the cafe with a story of a device that has applications for everything from search and rescue dogs to training household pets.
A couple of dog lovers who happen to be scientists at North Carolina State University have figured out a way to communicate with dogs. It's not a verbal conversation. It's more tactile. They developed a comfortable harness with a small computer mounted on it that allows dog owners to detect from a distance what Fido is doing and feeling, according to David Roberts.
This involves outfitting this harness with a bunch of sensors that are dedicated to monitoring the environment that the dog is in, as well as monitoring the dog itself, and then also being able to send inputs back to the dog via haptics, so gentle vibrations, much like you would feel when your cell phone goes off in your pocket.
The harness, which can record a dog's heartbeat and temperature and measure its activity level, is controlled wirelessly through a cell phone app. Roberts, a mathematician and computer scientist at NC State, says the device runs two programs and has a number of potential applications. One is to use it with service dogs that guide sight-impaired people. These dogs, says Roberts, are particularly vulnerable to stress, even though they're trained to remain very calm. The high-tech harness can also be used on search and rescue dogs and military dogs trained to locate explosives.
They're running out and they catch a whiff of something. They could be out at several hundred yards working away from the handlers, and the handler could get a little beep on a handheld device saying, hey, your dog is on some scent.
The beep on a cell phone tells the handler that a dog has laid down in front of a scent, as they are trained to do. The harness can be customized with environmental sensors that can detect hazards such as gas leaks, as well as a camera and microphone for collecting additional information. Haptic vibrations can also send precisely timed signals from the handler to help train a dog. Roberts and his colleagues are in the process of miniaturizing the computer and improving the physiological sensors so the harness can be used in animal shelters and hospitals. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
Fossils from California's La Brea tar pits keep supplying scientists with excellent material for studying the region's past. Ancient animals, from mammoths to tiny insects, reveal facts about climate changes during the last ice age and help scientists understand the modern climate. VOA's George Pudich is here in the cafe with us.
For millennia, natural tar that seeped from the ground in what is now Southern California trapped large and small animals, preserving their fossils and providing scientists with a trove of specimens suitable for study. A researcher at La Brea Tar Pits Museum, Anna Holden, is analyzing fossilized bees to learn about the ancient environment.
I'm trying to reconstruct what the climate was like and also what the local habitat. But this bee offered kind of unprecedented information in a way.
Exposing the fossils in a micro CT scanner, scientists discovered that the bee's habitat was warmer than expected, which led them to conclude that at the end of the Ice Age, about 11,500 years ago, this area was not covered with snow and ice as previously thought. Holden says that unlike the large mammals that came to La Brea from South America or across the Bering Strait, insects' limited range allows the collection of detailed information about their immediate environment. George Putich, VOA News, Washington.
I'm Ira Melman in the American Cafe. Please join us every day at voanews.com and many podcast platforms.
Hi, everyone. I'm David Byrd, and here's what's happening now. The Apple Watch might not be available to the public yet, but its competitors, including Samsung, Huawei, Sony, and others, are showcasing their products at the Mobile World Congress in Barcelona, Spain. Chinese company Huawei showed off its first smartwatch in Barcelona with a fully circular face and a metallic case. The watch is powered by Android Wear and boasts a touch-sensitive AMOLED display. Rhys Saunders is the UK's sales director for Huawei.
It's going to be that ability to interact with your smartphone to make it easier. And once people can see your latest tweet and reply to it on their wrist rather than actually dig into their pocket to get the phone, I just think it's a usability piece as well. But also very much we're all consumers and it's got to be what looks good on your wrist as well. And I think previously a lot of the wearables just haven't been that good to look at when wearing them.
South Korean giant Samsung, long going head-to-head with Apple for the world tech market, has its Gear 2 Neo, which is also powered by Android Wear. Rory O'Neill is Samsung's marketing director for Europe. He says that the company offers users a unique partnership with other companies, including airlines and car makers.
Samsung expects to be a leader in the smartwatch market and the wearables market as a whole. We've invested very heavily to build our entrance in the smartwatch market and the broader wearables market. We have great partnerships with Iberia so that people can get boarding cards on their wrist as we get to the plane, partnerships with BMW so people can control their cars from their smartwatch.
Sony's smartwatch 3 is the company's first device to run on Android Wear instead of on its own proprietary platform. Sarah Casimirazzi is Sony's wearable product manager. She says that future trends will have more input from consumers.
The consumers and us, we need to work together. We need to see the industry trends and also not only talk about fashion, but also talk about technology, but also talk about the services, but also fashion. Everyone wants to look good when they're wearing something. So make something that technology meets fashion, where you have all the elements of it into it.
One criticism of many smartwatches has been their lack of style. They have tended to be square and most don't look like fashion accessories. Everyday consumers, however, need to be persuaded that their smartwatch also looks good. Guess Watch's Senior Vice President of Global Products and Marketing, Elizabeth Thompson, says that fashion has to play a role in any smartwatch design.
We feel that it'll be a hybrid between smart technology as well as fashion, and probably almost everyone will be involved in some form of doing that in their brands.
Robert Carr is an analyst with U-Switch. He says that making smartwatches more fashionable will make them become indispensable to consumers, much in the same way that cell phones are now.
They need to become more of a fashion accessory rather than technology focused. When that happens, people will start to want to wear them more. They'll be sold in more shops instead of gadget shops. And within at least a couple of years, it'll be a choice between leaving your house with your phone or your watch and your watch is more of an accessory, and that'll be your main device.
A recent report by Forrester Research predicted that the number of people using a wearable device will triple this year, with the Apple Watch expected to draw 10 million users next year. Deloitte, meanwhile, has predicted that a majority of Internet of Things devices, not just smartwatches, but other devices as well, will be used by businesses and enterprises, not consumers. So what about you? Do you use or would you use a smartwatch instead of your smartphone? Do you have a favorite brand? Let us know your thoughts by logging on to our Facebook page, VOA Asia. And you can always email your questions or comments to voaasia@voanews.com. And that's what's happening now. Until next time, I'm David Byrd.
If you happen to be recently visiting Miami Beach, Florida, you may have run across a sign that was a bit confusing, welcoming tourists or, well, actually not. The flashing portable sign along the Julia Tuttle Causeway read, "Welcome, visitors prohibited." It was supposed to flash a message on three different screens, "Welcome, visitors, prohibited on the beach, glass, metal, alcohol, and styrofoam." Well, by late Tuesday, city officials apologized for the error. They took the sign away to have it corrected. It's sports time on The Voice of America. I'm Jim Stevenson. Golf is teeing off again this week in Africa, fittingly, at the African Open. Mark Tompkins is there with more on the tournament.
With 2014 champion Thomas Akin not here to defend his title this week, the stage is set in South Africa for what should be a fascinating 4 days of golf at the East London Golf Club that will be played against the stunning backdrop of the Indian Ocean. All six previous Africa Opens on this course have been won by South Africans, but only Darren Fischart, who triumphed here 2 years ago, is here this week. Jaco van Zyl finished tied second in Johannesburg last week, the best of the homegrown players. He's a fantastic record in this tournament and was joint second to Fischart in 2013. Andy Sullivan, who picked up his second win of the year in Johannesburg last week, heads up a large English contingent, while Ireland's Kevin Phelan, one of five joint runners-up last week, is also here. Louis Oosthuizen finished 27 under par when he won his second successive title in 2011. So for the second week running, whoever can score consistently well over the next 4 days could well be crowned Africa Open champion on Sunday afternoon.
Mark Tompkins reporting. Well, Alex Rodriguez was back in the batter's box. He lined a single into short left field Wednesday in his return to the New York Yankees after a 17-month absence and went 1-for-2 with a walk. He was greeted by a 10-second mix of boos and cheers as he stepped into the batter's box for his first game following a 1-year drug suspension. Rodriguez was wearing the Yankees' white uniform with pinstripes for the team's spring training home opener rather than the usual dark blue jersey used in exhibition games. He swung past a pair of 91-mile-per-hour pitches from Philadelphia's Kevin Slaoui in the first inning and then singled on an 89-mile-per-hour offering that was over the plate. That drew cheers from fans at Steinbrenner Field on a very sunny afternoon with very pleasant warm temperatures. The Minnesota Vikings and the Buffalo Bills have agreed on a trade that will send quarterback Matt Cassel to the Bills next week and fetch the Vikings some extra draft picks. Both teams announced the deal Wednesday, which will send two undisclosed draft choices to the Vikings with one undisclosed draft pick to Cassel to the Bills 6 days before NFL transactions can begin with the start of the new league year. Let's look at sports on VOA. The second album by the band Imagine Dragons, Smoke and Mirrors, recently debuted at number one on the Billboard 200 charts. It moved 195,000 units during the week ending February 22nd and 179,000 album sales. That's both physical and digital. Smoke and Mirrors features all kinds of instruments, including piano, along with impressive percussion and guitar. Back in 2013, the group from Las Vegas made quite a splash with their debut album, Night Visions. Many songs became favorites for fans, like Shots. Shots by Imagine Dragons. Their first album was about their journey to the top and how they worked so hard to get there. The new release is a little bit darker. It focuses on struggles and how hard life can be. The group has been tagged as an alternative music band, but for many critics, that label has proved a little bit difficult to nail down, as Imagine Dragons is able to cover a lot of varied sounds in a single album. Their brand new album, titled Smoke and Mirrors, and that's Imagine Dragons from VOA Global and our music segment. Well, Singapore topped the list as the priciest city to live in, according to a twice-yearly worldwide cost-of-living survey carried out by the Economist Intelligence Unit. In second place came Paris, followed by Oslo, Zurich, Sydney, and Melbourne. Geneva fell one spot to seventh. Copenhagen moved up two spots to number eight. Hong Kong took ninth, with Seoul rounding out the top ten. Now, New York, which is used to be used as the base city to compare all the other locations in the world, came in this time at number 22. It's also the first time Hong Kong has been listed in the top ten, although the city consistently makes the top 20 most expensive cities to live in. Hong Kong's currency, of course, is pegged to the U.S. dollar, so the resurgent greenback has seen the relative cost of living in that city increase, with high rents pushing up retail prices, although it's offset in other areas such as domestic help. Basic groceries, by the way, in Hong Kong, 31% more expensive than in New York City. That's compared to just 11% more for Singapore. Some items are actually cheaper, though, in Hong Kong, such as a kilo of long grain rice and a 750-milliliter bottle of table wine. They could go together quite well. Some of the cheapest places in the world to live in, Karachi in Pakistan, at the bottom of the list in that category worldwide, followed by Bangalore, Caracas, Mumbai, and Chennai. I don't see Washington, D.C. anywhere on there. Well, that could be good. Maybe not. That's where we're based. We're VOA Global. We'd like to thank our director, Tracy Carter, for today's program, our engineer, Zeynep Abdelrahman, and our managing editor, Diane Gao. Most of all, as always, we'd like to thank you for joining us today, and we hope you come back again tomorrow for another edition of VOA Global.